we were last together and beginning this three-part series, what we did was to begin an exploration or an inquiry into this very ancient tradition within Buddhism, within Buddha Dharma, the gesture of the tradition of the ritual of what's called going for refuge, or taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, known as the Triple Gem. And as we reflected on it, as we explored the topic when we were last together, we saw that this going for refuge or taking refuge is held in somewhat different ways by different traditions. So for instance, in the Tibetan tradition, going for refuge with a specific teacher can in fact be a lifelong commitment to being a student of that particular teacher or that guru. And likewise, becoming part of the lineage or the school of teachings of that particular guru. Okay. And so it's a very, very long-term kind of relationship that has some real, you know, gravitas attached to it. In other Buddha Dharma traditions, there's less emphasis on the teacher as guru, as one to whom one surrenders in terms of going for refuge, but a more sort of lateral relationship, one that really has more to do with just coming into community and sharing some teachings and reflecting together on what they might be. As we also talked about when we were together, whichever of the Dharma traditions that we're contemplating the going for refuge or taking refuge phenomenon from, there are certain aspects of it that are really worthy of deeper inquiry, ways to understand what it means to go for refuge or to take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. And during our three-part series here, what I want us to be able to do is to dig in a little, you know, somewhat beyond the surface and go into some of the richness of what it means to take these refuges. Okay. Perhaps the most frequently used simile that the Buddha offered in his teachings was one of, if you decide to take up the Buddha's teachings, he talks about walking the Eightfold Path, going on a journey, okay. Essentially an inward journey, a journey of inward inquiry, but you do it along with others, right? It's your own journey, but you're sharing that inner journey with others in Sangha or spiritual community. So in kind of theological lingo is applied to the teachings of the Buddha, one of the distinctions that comes up in the literature is this distinction between what's called the mundane and the supramundane. Okay. And mundane doesn't mean, you know, worthless or common or lesser. It comes from, of mundo, of the world, okay? Sort of the outward, the tangible, the visible, okay? And the supramundane refers more to the inner, the invisible, okay? Just, you know, the extra-rational, if you will, okay? And so, in looking at the three refuges, okay, if you're going forth on this spiritual journey, along the way, you're going forth from a place of comfort. You're going forth from a cocoon woven by your attachments and aversions and delusions. You're agreeing to go forth and see what else is out there, okay? And in so doing, then these refuges become a part of the journey. So the supramundane aspect, so there's an external, the literal historical meaning of taking refuge in the Buddha, okay, is taking refuge in the memory of a person who sought to find out what is the nature of this self-generated suffering that we experience in life. You know, where does it come from? Why does the mind do it? And how might it be brought to an end? How might it cease? Okay. So taking refuge in the Buddha can literally be taking refuge in the memory of someone. He said, my hardware and software is just like yours, or at least my hardware is. I've been working on the software for the last 45 years. But I am no different from you. I am not a god, and I should not be regarded as one. Okay. This is simply, when I talk about the path, I talk about the path that I walked, my own exploration, what I discovered. And I share it with you in the event that your goals, what you want in your own spiritual life, is the same thing I wanted, to discover why we suffer and how it might be brought to an end. And he said, if that likewise is your goal, then you might want to try doing some of these things that I did. Okay, and see if you have similar insights, and see if over time you begin to gain a similar freedom from self-generated suffering. That was his basic message. So, and he reiterated over and over and over again, he said, I would not ask you to do these practices if I did not know you could. Okay. So taking refuge in the Buddha, in the memory of this person who, accomplished this particular objective, is sort of the mundane aspect of what it means to take refuge in the Buddha. However, there is also this inner aspect, as I spoke about when the last time we were here, of taking refuge in the Buddha as well, of taking refuge in the Buddha within, in one's own Buddha nature. Some phrases that I know that I've shared in here frequently in the past, because they have particular meaning for me, and they are the ones that I certainly share when I'm working with someone whose life may be about to come to an end, because that's why these phrases were written in the first place. They're from a Tibetan text called the Book of Great Liberation on Hearing in the Baro. And they are verses that are read to someone whose life is coming to an end, usually by a spiritual benefactor or a family member or a dear friend. And it's something that is intended to act as a reminder to someone as their consciousness is leaving their body and going on this journey into the unknown. And the verses say, O nobly born, you who are the son or daughter of the Buddha, remember who you are in these times of change. Remember the Buddha who has taken birth in your very own form. Step out of the small self, this body of fear, and rest in generosity and kindness of heart. Rest in your own true virtue and wisdom. Rest in the graciousness of patience, the dedication and equanimity and compassion you share with all life. That is who you really are. Trust it and rest in your own true nature. They refer to the physical body as the fear body. And the reason is because it's hardwired to stay alive. And it's going to do whatever it can to stay alive. You know, if you've been with someone who's been dying in the past, then oftentimes there can be real peace of mind and they're quite prepared for the experience and they relax into a state of, a deep rest, stage 3 anesthesia and maybe just kind of moving on out. But at the very end, oftentimes the body's having none of it. It's going to go down swinging, because it is its nature, right? And so that's why they call it the fear body. It's just how it's wired. But to remember in this moment, these moments, that's not really who you are. That's just leftover, engine backfiring when it shuts down. It's just kind of, but it's not who you truly are. And so trying to be reminded of your own sort of Buddha nature is what the intention there is, and that there is that place. another way to get a feeling for it a little bit, this place of inner peace or spaciousness, one's Buddha nature, is captured in this book, Kitchen Table Wisdom, by Rachel Rimmett, who's a physician who's done a lot of work with people who are facing, serious physical and inevitably then some psychological or emotional challenges with regard to things having to do with their health, especially life-threatening disease. She says, in a book about Spain, I remember reading an interesting thing about bullfighting. There's a place in the bull ring where the bull feels safe. If he can reach this place, he stops running and can gather his full strength. He is no longer afraid. From the point of view of his opponent, he becomes dangerous. This is the place in the ring is different for every bull. It's the job of the matador to be aware of this, to know where sanctuary lies for each and every bull, to be sure that the bull does not occupy his place of wholeness. In bullfighting, the safe place is called the cadencia. For humans, the cadencia is a place in our inner world. Often it is a familiar place that has not been noticed until a time of crisis. Sometimes it is a viewpoint, a position from which to conduct life, different for each person. Often it is simply a place of deep inner silence. In working with people with cancer, I've seen the change what happens when a person finds their cadencia. In full view of the matador, they are calm and peaceful and wise. They have gathered their strength around them. The inner silence is more secure than any hiding place. So when I looked up the word cadencia in my Spanish dictionary, the definition of it was the place where wild things go to be safe. So it's like that inner sanctuary, that the wild part of us, the parts that's untamed, that's uncaptured by the discursive mind, where it goes to be safe. It's a place of spaciousness, of silence, a refuge. So that's one way of thinking about what it means to find the Buddha within. And then, might as well hear from the dude himself. The Buddha took a long time to die. He had eaten some rotten food. He was aware at the time that this meal he was being offered was in not such good shape. And he wound up contracting a serious gastrointestinal disease to which he eventually succumbed. So it was, I guess, probably as fortunate for his followers that it didn't go out, in the blink of an eye, because while he was dying, he had all these kind of teachings that he shared with others, right? And perhaps the most famous one is the advice that he gave to those who were gathered around him as he was near death, and they were sort of lamenting, and they were saying, oh, what are we going to do now that you are no longer here to share your teachings with us? They realized that they were really, had grown quite dependent upon him, kind of hanging on every word. And what he was advising them to do at the time was to turn inward. There are a very early translation of this particular text is the Parinibbana Sutra, the greater discourse on the Buddha's passing. Yeah, into the final state of nirvana, not in his body. And the earliest one is by in English language is by a translator named Rhys Davids, and its title is "Be a Lamp unto Yourself." And it's the stanzas are, therefore, Ananda, be ye lamps unto yourselves, be ye a refuge unto yourselves. Betake yourselves to no external refuge. Hold fast to the truth as a lamp. Hold fast to the truth as refuge. Look not for refuge in anyone beside yourselves. And those, Ananda, who either now or after I am dead shall be a lamp unto themselves, shall betake themselves to no external refuge, but holding fast to the truth as their lamp, holding fast to the truth as their refuge, shall not look for refuge to anyone besides themselves. It is they who shall reach the very topmost height, but they must be ready to learn. A modern Pali scholar, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is probably the foremost English language translator of all the texts of what the historical Buddha is actually thought to have said, said, well, Rhys Davids, his Pali wasn't very good. There was a book that had recently come out, and it was one of the first English language texts about the Buddha. It was called Light of Asia. Okay. And so he translated this particular word as lamp. Bhikkhu Bodhi said, well, no, not really. He said that the real meaning of that Pali word is island. But, you know, back in the 1600s, John Donne, the English poet, you know, no man is an island entire of itself. Everyone is a part of the main, therefore never sin to know for whom the bell tolls, tolls for thee. And so this notion of, you know, each person being an island is a little off-putting, perhaps, as well. And then likewise, in any altar you see, any Buddhist altar you see in Asia or here in the West, for that matter, if there are flowers, incense, and candles, the candles stand for the light of wisdom. However, says Bhikkhu Bodhi, the real translation of the word is island. Okay. Not island like a little sand spit in the middle of the Pacific with one palm tree and a guy, you know, waiting for a ship to come. Rather, an island like Sri Lanka, you know, an island that has a complete ecosystem, that has fresh water, and plants and animals, and that is in and of itself self-sufficient. Okay. So if you go back and read that text, you know, of Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, therefore, Ananda, be ye islands unto yourselves, be ye a refuge to yourselves, but take to yourselves no external refuge. Hold fast to the truth as an island within yourself. Hold fast to the truth as a refuge. Look not for a refuge in anyone beside yourselves. So what he's really teaching to these people as he's passing on, he's saying, you know, in order for what I have taught you to fully ripen and for you to be ready to go forth and share it with others, you have to acknowledge that while the words that I said had real value for you, it's not simply that I said them that matters, that has transformed your life and your consciousness. What matters is that you heard those words and they became your truth, your lived experience. Okay. They became your dharma, not just a doctrine. They became the reality of your own existence. And so he said that, and you know, kind of segueing into what does it mean to take refuge in the Dhamma now, of course, as well. But the point he's trying to make over and over again, you know, is that there's not some guy in the sky, there's not some deity, there's not some external authority figure, there's not somebody else that you've got to be looking for or looking to hang your hat on. It's a principal distinction between Buddha Dharma, which is a non-theistic tradition, and the theistic traditions of the world. Okay. Betake yourselves no external refuge. You've got everything you need inside. You know, trust, you know, like I said in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, trust your own Buddha nature. It's been there all along. It's just a matter of allowing it to come forth, to find its voice, to mature. So before I start making a few comments about taking refuge in the Dhamma, is there anything that I've said about taking refuge in yourself and your own Buddha nature that resonated with you, or that you'd like to explore more fully, or do you have a question about? Here we go. Please.
I get the island thing. And the, that ultimately, you know, that your happiness is not depending on conditions, you know, outside yourself or in your body or whatever. But I don't know. I wonder how that, I mean, until you're enlightened, I wonder how that fits with the when Ananda says that noble friends and noble conversation is half of the life. You know, because it seems really important to be able to have your friends around and be able to bounce this stuff off them and have them get it.
One of the prerequisites for being able to embark upon this particular path, to inquire into the Buddha's teachings, to learn the extent to which they seem to resonate with your own understanding, is being comfortable with paradox. Because, you know, on the one hand, he's saying just that. He's saying, if you feel that your own spiritual well-being, okay, your own ability to know what is true, your own ability to live with integrity, your own ability to be a compassionate person in the world, is dependent upon somebody else telling you what to do, is dependent upon you getting validation from somebody else, okay, then you've not fully learned what I've been teaching. And in another meeting, just as you said, you know, at another time, in another place, when Ananda was saying, you know, it seems like noble conversations with noble friends is half the holy life. You know, when we get together in 2 weeks and talk about Sangha, we're going to be going back to that very teaching. And of course, you know, Ananda is this kind of straight man. He'd say these things, and then the Buddha would say, "Oh no, Ananda, do not say this because it's, you know, you're mistaken." Of course, another face plant for Ananda. So he said, "No." He said, "Surely, noble friends and noble conversations is the entirety of the holy life." The distinction that we've got here is he's talking, on the one hand, in terms of finding the Buddha within, your inner refuge. Okay. It's kind of like, you know, the warp engines. It's like you your own wisdom, your own grounding and faith in your own wisdom and compassion is what gives you the motive energy and the insight to live the Buddha's teachings. So that's the fount. That's kind of where it comes from. If you see the Dharma wheel here, you know the eight aspects, the eightfold path it's called, you know, the meditative aspects of effort and concentration and mindfulness that kind of prepare the soil, that prepare the mind to be able to recognize insights, you know, insights into who and why you are the way you are, okay. Insights into all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who you are in this moment. So one of the two wisdom factors, right understanding and right view or right thought, you know, that's insight into who you're going to be in the next minute. It's insight into your own motives so that you can recognize the wholesome from the unwholesome in terms of motivation. Okay, and so that's the two wisdom factors. And then lastly are the manifestation of the meditative factors and the wisdom factors in how we speak, in how we act, and in how we live our lives. Okay. All of those activities are interactive. They're mundane. They happen in the world. Okay. And they're just as important. The reason it's, you know, it's laid out here like spokes on a wheel is because there, no one can be weaker or stronger than the other. They're all equally important. They balance each other out. Okay. They happen in a social context. The reason the Buddha said that Sangha is so critical, spiritual community is so critical, is that, you know, even though we have this wisdom and compassion, this Buddha nature that rises within us, what's going on within us at the same time is a lot of competition for our attention and for our action and whatnot. And when it looks like we've kind of, you know, the wheels are coming off a little bit and we're kind of losing focus and we're edging toward saying or doing something that's kind of unskillful, if you are in community with others who recognize the symptoms, okay, they can help you, you know, in a kind way. We can kind of witness to each other. We can be mirrors to each other, reflect each other in terms of what we're thinking, what we're saying, what we're doing, and kind of remind each other of the Buddha within. So when we like take refuge at the beginning of a sitting or the beginning of a retreat, that's kind of what we're doing. We're reminding each other of these kind of inner qualities. Yeah, please, Don.
In the Zen tradition, a lot is made about the interconnectedness of all beings, of all life.
Yes, yeah.
You know, one with all beings, and that's sort of pivotal realization. But I always sort of saw that as sort of one of the deeper realizations that come with practice, as opposed to simple acknowledgement of the social context in which the practice is occurring.
Understanding the interconnectedness at some fundamental level.
At the absolute rock bottom, we are all one. Is, I think, what it's saying in Zen, but I, you know.
Yeah, well, a few points in the Pali Canon, in the discourses, the Buddha says, you know, there is this teaching called Paticca Samuppada, or codependent arising, or dependent origination. Basically, it's the teaching that everything creates everything else all the time, and everything is arising and passing, you know, constantly. And so it's interconnection at a level more fundamental than we're usually capable of comprehending. So in that particular regard, this notion of an island or one separate, you know, basically another way to understand that would be ecosystems unto yourselves. Because it's this, you know, it's not an isolated kind of individual, it's this continuous arising, changing, passing away, arising, changing, passing away, and the insight into the fact that that's going on, it's going on for all of us, it's going on for everything in the world all the time, and to be able to begin to comprehend that a little bit is to really help to be able to begin to let go of this notion of a discrete, permanent, separate, and abiding self. So it's murky stuff, and language is you know, slippery here. But what, on the one hand, what his translation is trying to get at is, you know, don't feel like because the dude died, you're going to run out of gas. You know, all he said, all I was here to do was to awaken something in you that you've already got happening. Okay. And the beauty of Sangha is one that it helps keep that awake. It helps sustain that which is in you. So he didn't say go off and sit on a mountaintop by yourself. Not at all. What he was saying is that he was trying to disabuse them of the dependence that he saw with them. He said, that's not really so helpful. It's not really what I was trying to get across. Thank you. Taking refuge in the doubt? Oh, please, please.
But that is interesting that even, you know, the people around him when he was dying felt that they were becoming too dependent on him. Tell me I'm okay. Tell me this. I can relate to that.
Yes.
That for me is a struggle that I think if I can continue to find it within myself, that is really one of my biggest goals right now in my life, mm-hmm. is to find this peace, this knowing. I happened to go to Mile High last week, and it was a very similar talk about self-love.
Yep.
And then having your actions, every choice that you make in your life then is, you're taking really good care of yourself. You know this, that you're valuable.
Uh-huh.
And so all of your actions come out of that. It's a very similar message.
Quite so. Learning to trust yourself, sort of in a more fundamental way,
yeah.
than perhaps you have. And it's, yeah, please.
Kind of going along with what she was saying, you're always having a hard time with, did I just drink the Kool-Aid just because this dude says so, and I feel like, well, that's cool, I want to follow that. At the same time, I just don't trust myself, or if I don't trust enough of my good nature or some kind of wisdom, so I just, sometimes I just cannot distinguish between.
Yes.
Is this truth, or is this some kind of phony stuff?
Yes.
Or even like when you belong to some kind of community, other than, you know, this, you know, community is great, sounds great, but for example, in work situation or some kind of social association you belong to, and sometimes you're not so sure, you know, it sounds great, but at the same time, I just cannot trust it, and I feel like there's some kind of tendency there. Should I trust my instinct, or is there any other
what you all are doing is providing a wonderful segue into having a look at what it means to take refuge in the Dharma, which again has its mundane and super mundane aspects to it. So taking refuge in the Dharma, what does the word mean? A lot of translations. One is truth. Other is teachings, other is law, as in natural law, the way, you know, which is that which is in accord with nature. So you'll find, you know, you may have noticed in my teaching I talk about Buddha Dharma, or the teachings of the Buddha, more than I use the word Buddhism, and the reason for that is that the word Buddhism is a West European academic construct. It came into being in the 18th century when Asia was being colonized by the West, and there are these comparative religion types that were trying to figure out, you know, what the extant religions were there and how to make sense of them. And they did that, of course, by comparing what they knew to what they didn't know, and then using the language of the stuff they did know and applying it to what they didn't know, and doing a certain amount of conceptual violence to it along the way. Which is why I use the phrase Buddha Dharma, literally the teachings of the Buddha. There are other dharmas that other teachers would offer. This is the one that he happened to offer. And it comes in myriad forms, and it has different texts and different traditions. All of them purporting to be the words of the Buddha. One of my primary teachers and friends, Joseph Goldstein, wrote a book a few years ago called One Dharma. And what he had seen happening here in the West was that we had all these various Buddha Dharma traditions from various parts of Asia, all making their way to the West. And in many ways, they had relatively little in common, or at least the ones, you know, the way they were being brought over, the way they were being taught. What also was, came across was a lot of the sectarianism that was going on in Asia, with all these different ways of thinking about what the Buddha said and all the different ways that the teachings got admixed with the cultures that sustained them and whatnot. And there were all these different schools and views and ideas and whatnot. And he decided, you know, I think it's time for us to move the focus away from how they're all distinguishable from each other to what they hold in common. And so, and there are places, you know, where the Buddha actually said there are not many dharmas but one. And this one dharma, you know, is what he felt we needed to focus upon. So someone asked him once after he finished his book, you know, is there anything that you found in common across all these different schools of Buddhism? He said, yes, there is no Buddhist school that says cling. So, you know, the idea of the Four Noble Truths, you know, that yeah, suffering exists, and yeah, it's caused by, you know, craving and clinging, and yes, it is possible to train the mind to not crave and cling, and da-da, here's how you do it, the Eightfold Path. In one way or another, you find those teachings coming through in terms of, you know, just your basic core dharma, as far as, you know, the teachings, the literal teachings. So taking refuge in these teachings, in the Buddha's recorded experience of inner exploration and how he found the answer to the questions that he set forth to find the answers to, is what constitutes the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha. And he was out on the road doing, you know, his shtick and got invited to visit a spiritual community, the Kalamas. And there is a sutra, a teaching of the Buddha's, a discourse called the Kalamas Dilemma. And it has to do with when, you know, they'd have one spiritual teacher after another come to town and do their spiel, and so he did his spiel and talked about, you know, the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path and bringing suffering to an end. And they said, yeah, well, that's nice, but last week some guy came through here and he was an eternalist. He said there is a God, there is a soul, and they last forever. And then before that was somebody called a nihilist who said nothing exists. Party on, you know, no consequence. And why should we believe you any more than we should believe any of these others? And his answer was, you should not. He said, let's go back to square one. I set out to discover the nature of suffering, especially that suffering which we cause ourselves, where it comes from, why we do it, and how it can be brought to an end. I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. If your goal likewise is to discover why we suffer, and with particular regard to this kind of self-generated dissatisfaction of suffering, and how it might be brought to an end, if your goal is the same as mine, in other words, then you may want to give some of what I'm suggesting here a try. You know, listen to these teachings, do some of these practices, see if they work for you. If indeed you have the same experience that I did when I came across this stuff. If indeed you do, then the words that I shared with you will no longer be just text. They will not any longer be just some doctrine. They will be your lived reality. They will be the truth of your experience. They will be your dharma. So that is a transformation from the outer, those 5,000 printed pages of the Buddha's, you know, teachings, okay, and the Nikayas, the collections, okay. The transformation of that which you found in those teachings that speaks to you in a very fundamental way and causes a shift in the way you understand yourself and the way you interact with the world. And when that fundamental shift occurs, that change in perception, change in view, that affects a change in behavior and a change in understanding, okay, then the Dharma has become your Dharma. It has become internalized. It has become who you are. So, taking refuge in the Dhamma, in your Dharma internally, is taking refuge in your ability to know what is true, insofar as how to bring suffering to an end. However, the tricky business here, as you pointed out, is the teachings in the Dharma traditions are basically that, you know, we come into this world seeing the world through the lenses of our desires and our aversions, okay? So he was saying, don't do this practice because I told you to. Either my practice or anyone else that comes along. He said, if you do the practice because the guy is really smart or good looking or rich or he's got a big following, you know, or all your friends say you should, he said, that's really shaky ground to build your spiritual life on. So the only thing worth building your spiritual life on is what's true for you. And in order for you to know what's true for you, you have to be able to figure out, to recognize when you're hosing yourself. So like the Buddha said, you know, we become what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. Okay. Speak or act with unwholesome purpose, and sorrow shall follow you as surely as the wheels on the cart follow the oxen who draw it. We become what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. Speak or act with wholesome intention, and happiness will follow you as your shadow unswerving. When we're looking at the world through the lenses of greed, hate, and delusion, you know, then we're likely to speak and act in ways that are harmful to ourselves and others. Okay. When we're not looking at the world that way, we won't. So, making this Dharma yours involves learning how to perceive clearly when you are and when you are not looking at the world through those particular lenses, you know. Kali Rinpoche's famous little poem, you know, you live in illusion and the appearance of things. That's what he's talking about. You know? We, for the most part, see the world through the lens of our own needs and wants, our own fears, our own anxieties, and we block everything else out that we don't want to look at. Okay. You live in illusion and the appearance of things. Says there is a reality and you are that reality, but you do not know it. When you realize this is so, you will see that you are nothing, and that being nothing, you are everything. That is all. What Kali Rinpoche is talking about is the ability to see the world from a non-self-referential point of view. To be able to see things as they are, with eyes unclouded by fear and longing, as the Buddha said. Right? When it's capable, you know, when you find yourself, even for little moments at a time, you know, you're sitting and you see that you're in the throes of one or another, these unwholesome mind states, and then for a minute you're not. And when you have that moment of mindfulness, okay, the moment of mindfulness, the moment of clarity, is basically a moment of looking back. Because in the moment, you can see that the mind was taken up with anger or frustration or ill will or, you know, fear or whatever. In the moment you recognize the mind to be in that state, it's not in that state anymore. At that moment, you're being mindful, you're being clear. You're able to see that in the immediate preceding moment, that's what you were feeling. And maybe that's what you're going to feel in the next moment. And then there's going to be another moment of mindfulness. So what happens the more you do this practice is that, and especially if you're on retreat, that those moments of mindfulness, more and more of them begin to appear. And they start getting strung together, you know, like beads on a mala, you know. And then what happens as a result of that, your ratio of experiencing afflictive emotions, for instance, and your moments of mindfulness, the ratio begins to change. So when you first start sitting, you may just be in the throes of mind states that you don't really particularly appreciate being in. And every once in a while, there's a moment of mindfulness, and you see there, in some ways, it makes it even ickier to realize that what's going on. But then little by little bit, the more you practice, the more mindful you become, you know, the more the moments of mindfulness begin to shove out the other ones. And you begin to disempower those mind states. They don't have the control over you that they used to. Okay? This is what taking refuge in the inner Dharma is really all about. Okay? It's taking refuge in your capacity to know what's true, to be able to see clearly in a way that you couldn't before. And then as the Buddha said, as this ability to see things more and more clearly strengthens, okay, and the unwholesome states of mind and motive get progressively weaker, okay, then the Dharma becomes yours in a very fundamental way, until you and the Dharma basically become indistinguishable. And so that's what it means to really take refuge and the Dharma in this kind of internal sense. Okay. Faith in your ability to know what's true. Faith in your ability to understand when you're coming from a not so wholesome place and to see what the consequences are likely to be. Faith in your ability to understand the wholesome. Faith in your memories of times when you acted on the wholesome and did not act on the unwholesome and the beneficial effect it's had on your life. Okay. This Dharma is not just words in a book. Okay. The teachings are there, and they are words in a book, but the reason that Buddha Dharma is still around, and the reason that we still practice it, and the reason that it still transforms lives over and over and over again, is because aspects of those teachings, literally, if our goals are the same as the Buddha's, become who we are, and with the same effect. Let's sit together for a couple of minutes. We live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. We are that reality, but we do not know it. When we realize this is so, we will see that we are nothing, and that being nothing, we are everything. That is all. for being here tonight. Hope you enjoy David's talk next week, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.